Okay, good morning, everybody. It's so nice to be here. I very much enjoyed last year when we learned together. So on my once yearly trip here, I like to have this opportunity. How much you can hear me clearly? Okay, good. Okay, so our topic for today is a deep look at the concept of tsniut. I think that what happens is that in our society, when you hear the concept of tsniut, you right away think about woman and dress code. We're going to learn that tsniut is actually something very, very wide, which once we understand the wider concept, one small aspect of it is woman and dress code, but it's actually something much, much, much wider than that. And if we're going to get right into it, how do we know that this must be something very wide? So if you look at your the first source, which is the Gemara and Masechet Makot, Kaf Dalet, the Gemara says something very interesting. It talks about a certain process. Yes, okay, I have to keep reminding myself. Okay, so we all know that Moshe Rabbeinu gave us Taryag Mitzvos, gave us 613. At the time that the Torah was given, people were able to contain and remember 613 principles at one time. Try that on us right now. We know that we keep 613, but most of us cannot rattle them off one after the other. So there's a certain process. And in David HaMelech's generation, David decides that in order for people to be able to contain whole Torah in their hands, he condenses 613 mitzvot to 11 basic principles. We still keep all 613, obviously, but they are represented in 11 principles. The Gemara goes on to say that in a later generation, Yeshayahu took David's 11 and condensed them to 6. Va Yeshayahu v'amidan al shesh, if you follow the source. And this process keeps going on. Ba Micha, I'm on the second line of the first source, v'hamidan al shalosh. And really that's what we're going to get to today. I'm going to get back to that. But if you skip to the end of the second to last line, Ba Chavakuk v'hamidan al achat. The final level in this process was Chavakuk, who says that all 613 mitzvot can be condensed into one principle, and that is Tzadik be'emunato yechiyah, emuna, belief in God is all 613 principles, kind of in one power pill, if you want to call it. What I want to do for the purpose of today's discussion is to go back to the second to last in this process, which is Micha. Micha, in Parak Vav and Sefer Micha, and we're going to look at the second source on the sheet, Micha says that all of Torah can be condensed into three basic principles. Yigid lecha adam, ma tov, u'ma Hashem doresh mimcha. Let me tell you what is good and what God demands of you. Ki im asot mishpat, avat chesed, v'atzne alechet melokecha. There's three principles here. Doing mishpat, I'm going to define what we're talking about, chesed, and hatzneh lechet imelkecha is the third. So mishpat, we're going to define, mishpat means law. And all the details of the Torah, and all the things that we follow, very specific halachos, are condensed into the concept of mishpat. Then you have chesed. And chesed represents the inner world that Hashem wants you to develop in terms of your compassion towards other people and the emotions that He wants you to achieve through Torah. That's all condensed into this concept called chesed. And then we have the third principle. V'hatzneh lechet imelkecha. Walk modestly with Hashem. Now, the reason why I bring the source first is because clearly anything which represents a third of the Torah is not only talking to women, and it's not only talking about dress code, because a third of those 613 mitzvot are encapsulated into this concept of walking modestly with God. And the pasuk is gender neutral, it's not just talking to women, and it's obviously a very, very wide, broad concept that we have to understand what this really is. And that's going to help us define tsniut in a wider way. Okay, So I explained basically what mishpat is and basically what chesed is. But what's the third thing? What is this hatzne'a lechet emelokecha, walk modestly with God? So in order to understand this, we're going to look at the third source. The Gemara in Sukkah Memtes. The Gemara tries to explain to us lechet emelokecha, walk modestly with God. And the Gemara says, hatzne'a lechet emelokecha, zo hotza'at hamet v'achnasat kala. That the place where we see, where we learn this concept of walking modestly with Hashem, is at a wedding and at a funeral. The Gemara then goes on to give a kal v'chomer, v'halo dvarim kal v'chomer, ma dvarim shedarcham la'asotan b'farhesya, amra Torah hatznei alechet. If the Torah is telling you that when you're in a public place, and the wedding is a public place, and a funeral is a public place, if when I'm walking, when I'm in public, I have to be walking privately with Hashem. Al achas kama v'kama. The source got cut off here. The source says achas v'kama dvarim shedarcham la'asotan b'tzina. That of course, when you're doing a mitzvah privately, you should be walking modestly with Hashem. Now, what's the kal v'chomer here, and why does the Gemara say that you have to walk modestly with Hashem when you're at a wedding and at a funeral? What are we learning from this? There's a few different ways to interpret this, and I have a certain routine that I like to go through to demonstrate one of the things. What happens to us when we go to a wedding? We walk into a wedding, and maybe some of you will not relate to this, but this is like kind of a Jewish woman's type of thing. You walk into the wedding, and the first thing you're trying to think is if you're late or on time. Am I casually late? Am I embarrassingly late? Where's the wedding holding vis-a-vis where I just walked in? And I'm self-conscious if I walk in at the wrong time. Too early, too late, usually too late and not too early. But and then I kind of look around and I see how people are dressed. And I try to figure out if I'm overdressed for this occasion, underdressed. They're all very formal. I'm a little informal. I go up to the kala to say mazel tov to her. And I'm aware, is she distracted when she's talking to me? Is she already waiting to say mazel tov to the next person? Is she relating to me? And then, when it comes time for the dancing, you know, the younger girls here might relate to this. There's a whole song to who the kala calls in for the first dance. If you're a very close friend, first the relatives, then the close friend. And if you're not called in for the first dance, you're very aware of who was called in for the first dance. And she just met that girl yesterday. I've known her for 20 years. Why wasn't I called in? You have the aggressive people who push their way in. You have other people who people push them in. And there's a whole thing around that. And then it's time for the regular dancing. And I'm kind of aware if I know this dance, don't know this dance, if I'm stepping on people's toes or not. Should have taken some Israeli dancing, didn't. What's the problem with this? The self-talk the whole time is me. If I'm late, if I'm overdressed, if I'm getting attention, if I'm dancing well, I came for the kala, not for myself. But we are so self-conscious in public situations that we tend to think that the limelight is on us. And we're aware, we're evaluating, we're embarrassed. And really, I'm not the center of this event. So why is it so important what impression I'm making? And you know, sometimes this is true with little children. I know that I have a young daughter who, you know, occasionally if I would braid her hair or something and it was a little off-center or didn't have the bow that she wanted, she would say to me something like, well, all the kids in the class are gonna laugh at me. To which I would say back to her, Bubala, most of them will not notice, and the ones who notice will forget in a second, they have other things to think about. And yet we as adults, when we are self-conscious, we tend to think that people are noticing us, and it's the same thing. Most won't notice. The ones who notice are not thinking 3 hours later, wow, she really overdressed for that occasion. Can't get that off my mind for the whole wedding, I'm just noticing that lady overdressed. There's something about the human nature where we tend to think that the focus is on us. And the Torah is giving you an antidote to that. The Torah is telling you, Hatznei lechet emelokecha. Walk modestly with Hashem. What does this mean in this particular context? It's very interesting. There's a mashgiach in yeshiva in Haifa by the name of Uri Weissblum, whose writings I enjoy very much. And he has a certain way that he explains human behavior. Fascinating. He says, many aspects of our behavior seem very silly. But the reason why God gave us this tendency to be this way, is because if we sublimate it, we could use it for a higher purpose. I'll give you an example. Imitation, the fact that we imitate people. So the first time a new style in shoes comes into style, the first time you see it, you often look at it and say, that's the most awful thing I've ever seen. And then, thank you so much, so nice of you. Thank you. And then, the first time you saw those pair of shoes, you thought they were pretty ugly. And then after you watch around 500 people wear them, you find yourself buying them because they're kind of cute. So that, what is that? It's such a funny thing that we imitate styles, we imitate what people wear, even when we inside us don't like it, we're doing it anyway. Rav Weisselberg says something so beautiful. He says, why did Hashem put in you the nature to imitate? He says, because its lower manifestation is following people's shoes. Its higher manifestation is what Chazal say, Mahu rachum af ata rachum. Imitate him. Be like Hashem. So that koach, that trait, which could be so superficial, could also be used in the most sublimated way possible. And similarly, we're going to talk about this trait over here. The attention seeking, or the awareness of the feedback that I'm getting from people, is such a superficial thing. When I walk into a room and I think that everybody's noticing what I'm wearing and what I'm doing, especially when they didn't come for me, they came for the kala, what is that? The sublimated place for this midah of being aware of the attention you're getting, Pasuk says, Einav mishotetot b'kol ha'aretz. Hashem's eye sees everything. And I am, somebody is looking at me. But it's not the lady sitting at the next table. It's Hashem. And that's why the Gemara in Sukkah says that the place for Hatzneh Lechatz Im Elokecha is at a wedding and at a funeral. It's this paradox that dafka when you're around a lot of people and you're aware and you think that people are looking at you, sublimate that and say, I'm walking with Hashem. He's the only one who really cares. And you become, instead of a superficial person who's addicted to public validation, you become a more spiritual person who is aware that I have a relationship with Hashem. I would like to say that in today's world, this midah is more important than ever. Why? Because narcissism is on the rise. And narcissism is really defined as a person who views themselves as being the center, and they're like the main performer, and everybody's the players in their world. And they exploit people because if this person's good for my image, I'll be friends with them. And if that, not, I'll discard them. So this idea of thinking that you're in the center is becoming more and more and more part of the human experience. So if the Gemara told us back then that be careful when you're at a wedding and remember that Hashem is looking at you, more so. And I like to say that part of what all the social media does to us is that it also convinces us that we're the center of everybody's world. Facebook, the idea that I might post that I just had my first Israeli falafel today, or look at the sweater I bought for my grandson, and I think that hundreds of people are getting out of the shower to come look at what I posted, I turned myself into a Hollywood star. I like to say there's the narcissistic bond. Today I'm the Hollywood star and you're the fan. And then tomorrow when you post, you're the Hollywood star and I'm the fan. But we've convinced ourselves that the whole world is dying to know every little detail about our lives. This promotes narcissism. It's hard for a person to put himself in perspective and say that I'm not the only person around here when that's what the social media is promoting so much. So the answer to this is Hatzneh Lechet Im Elokecha. Really, Hashem cares. Don't convince yourself that you need so much public attention, because really, you're in a relationship with Him. And that's what Hatzneh Lechet Im Elokecha means. It's interesting because I brought this idea once to a shiur I give in Yerushalayim sometimes, a very interesting shiur. It's a group for senior citizens, and half the group are religious, are Orthodox, and half of the people are completely not religious. They come together every week, the woman from a left-wing kibbutz and the others from a very religious Orthodox community, and they come and they learn together every week. It's very special. So one of the women who did not come from a religious background comes over to me after the shiur, and she says to me, you know, you just explained something that happened around 70 years ago. So I said, oh, let's hear. She said, you know, when I was a little girl, I had an aunt who was very, very narcissistic. But those words were not used so much at that time. And one time my father was trying to help me understand why I have such a hard time with this aunt. And the woman looks at me, she says, my father never saw the Talmud, I promise. And what did he say to me? He said, you know why you have a hard time with this aunt? Because she thinks that she's the bride at every wedding and the corpse at every funeral. I said, maybe somewhere somebody there saw this Gemara. Exactly what we're trying to say. The narcissistic person feels that they're in the middle of everything. And Atzneh Lechen Elokecha is telling you, remember that you're the center of God's world and not of everybody else's. Now I have a question for you. Why is it not narcissistic to think that I'm the center of God's world? It's also a little ego inflated. Why is it not? Because you're the center of God's world, but so are billions of other people at the same time. He's able to look and care about many people. So it's not that I'm the center stage and everybody else is off the stage, but rather, he looks at everybody. So it's there's something balanced about it. It's not self-aggrandizing. I'd like to just say that this midah, even though when we talk about the narcissistic personality disorder, it's an extreme kind of a person, but people have different levels of narcissism in them. And Hatzneh Lechet is trying to put me back into a place where I don't let the unpleasant aspects of narcissism take over. I like to say about this that I once went to a workshop. I go sometimes for, you know, professional enrichment, learning about topics in psychology. So the topic was a narcissistic personality disorder. And really, according to the DSM, this is 1% of society. You know, I think it's on the rise. But at least the DSM-4 said it was 1%, which means, and the narcissistic personality disorder is somebody who's extremely, extremely self-focused. Somebody who exploits other people, like I said, very, very into themselves, very difficult to get along with these kind of people, and also very difficult to have compassion for them. So the presenter was saying something very interesting. He was saying that you really have to have compassion towards the narcissistic person. Why? And he said something fascinating. He said, if you've ever performed in a play, when you perform, you're a little bit, you know, nervous, and you get to the end of the act, and the curtain goes down, and then you can relax. That's what the performers do behind the scene. They giggle, they laugh, they take a drink. The narcissistic person is somebody for whom the curtain never goes down. They're performing their whole lives. They always think that people are looking at them. And therefore, they're in like an emotional straitjacket. They can't take out the garbage because they might be seen. They can't do anything humane because they're supposed to be special. And you really have to have compassion towards people who always think that they're being observed. So this midah helps us not get to that extreme. And if we redefine Hatzneh Lechet and Elokecha, and here I'd like to get to a working definition of what the concept means. The word l'hatznia as a verb does mean to cover up. But we often take it only as covering up the body. What it really means, according to this definition, is the covering up of the ego. I don't want all of my actions in life to be affected by my ego. I don't want to have ulterior motives. I don't want to be thinking all the time about myself, my presentation, my image. So we are being matznia. We are covering something. We're covering the ego. And now we can understand why Micha says that this represents a third of the Torah. Because if one third of the Torah is mishpat, following the laws, another third of the Torah is chesed, having the right emotions, another third of the Torah is going to be doing things for the right reasons. That everything that I do should be done for the right reasons, with the ultimate goal of becoming close to God, and surely not being motivated by my ego and my public image. I would like to say But I think in religious communities, this is something that's a challenge. For a Jew who might live alone in some city in Idaho, anytime they do a mitzvah, they're clearly not getting public feedback from the environment if the environment is not Jewish. But when you live in a Jewish community, and specifically religious communities, there's a lot of positive peer pressure, I would call, which is better than negative peer pressure. But one of the side effects of it is that when I do a public mitzvah, when I do an act of kindness, I get validation for it, because that's the value system that we live in, thank God. But it's always going to be a side effect, is that when I do something nice, people will know and say, oh, she's a good person. So this midah becomes more necessary to work on in the Jewish community context, because I could, in a sense, become addicted to the public feedback for the things that I do. And the Gemara is telling you that there's a kal v'chomer. Your public mitzvot are being done for Hashem, your private mitzvot are being done for Hashem, and we have to kind of wean ourselves off of the need for feedback for everything that we do. Okay, so I think we have a little bit of a working definition here. And now that we do, I would like to see where we can understand this concept and how it works. So if we skip down, very important. Rashi on the Gemara in Sukkah gives a very practical piece of advice that I think we could use if we want to work on this concept. Rashi says that, I see here, unfortunately, the wrong source was quoted, so I'm going to quote the source that I meant, a certain Rashi. This is the right one, I'm sorry. Okay, I'm going to hold it here. Okay, pick it up. Hold it. Is this better? Okay. Thank you. Thank you for telling me. Okay. Rashi on the Gemara in Sukkah, in the third source. Im tzarich lebazbez lehosaat meit ani o lehachnasat kala aniya yaseh b'tzina. Rashi is saying that if you have to spend money for the funeral expenses or for the kala who might not have enough money for expenses, do it privately. And here Rashi is giving us a very interesting piece of advice. He's saying, you're going to do a mitzvah of making a kala happy. Certain aspects of that mitzvah are going to be public. You're not going to not dance for the kala because people look. Poor kala, what did she do? She didn't do anything wrong. I'm doing a public mitzvah, and people are going to notice. But I want to be tzanua. I want to walk privately with Hashem. Rashi's saying something fantastic. He's saying, find something to do for the kala that nobody will know about. You'll maintain the balance of being able to be private in your actions. And this could be anything like, I'm going to dance for her, people are going to notice. But as I was walking into the wedding, I said a silent prayer for her, that she should have a good life with Shalom Bayit. Nobody knows that I daven for her right now. That was the private aspect. Or maybe I'll write her a card that only she will see. Or maybe if she doesn't have money, I'll give a donation towards her expenses that nobody knows about. Rashi's telling you that in a public world, you have to work on the private aspects of your mitzvah in order to have the right perspective. Such a great piece of advice. Do something a little extra that's private. And I want to tell you something very interesting thing. I taught this idea somewhere, and somebody told me that they know somebody who was running a parlor meeting for raising funds for a very poor organization in Israel. I think in an organization that was given to needy families or to terror victims. Some very, very worthy cause. Now, the purpose of the parlor meeting was to give, people should bid a certain amount of money. And the man asked his rabbi the following question. He said, if I give a high bid, other people at that meeting will probably also bid high. So more money will go to this poor organization. And yet, there's something about public bidding, which is very not private, and not tanua, the way we just define tanua. So what should I do? The rabbi said something very interesting to him. He said, give a high bid publicly, because you'll get other people to, you know, everybody will give more to this organization. And then, privately, give more than you bid. So there's a private aspect here that people don't have to know about. And this is kind of what Rashi's saying. If we do public mitzvot,
We should add a private aspect and nobody will know that, because it helps us maintain the idea that this is really between me and Hashem. Yes. Well, I'm not sure if I'm understanding correctly, but the Chazal, she's asking about what's a more important mitzvah, chnasat orachim or giving tzedakah privately. Is that what you said? So the Chazal, the Gemara talks about the different levels of giving tzedakah, and one of the highest levels, according to the Gemara, is when I give and I don't know who I'm giving to, and the person who receives doesn't know who they receive from. And now, to the light of this, we can understand why that's true. Because there's something about privacy in mitzvot that enhances the mitzvah. I'm going to take questions at the end. Please hold on to your question. Because yes, right. But tzedakah is private tzedakah, is even more than the public tzedakah. But I will take questions. The pasuk that really becomes like the poster pasuk for this midah is the pasuk in Yeshayahu Samech Aleph, source number 4. Such a beautiful pasuk. Ayin lo rata Elokim zulatecha. Translated meaning, Hashem, no eye saw this except for you. Meaning, I'm trying to do actions that I could say about it, Hashem, no eye observed the action that I just did except for you, Hashem. That is being tsanua. That's being private. And a person tries, as much as some of the things we do are known to people, we want to maintain that there are certain actions that I do that no eye observed it other than Hashem. And you know what this does for us? It builds our depth of our character. It builds the real me. The real me doesn't really even care if you notice and you thank me, or you think I'm great, or you think I'm wonderful. This is about my relationship with Hashem. And I like to say that this midah of working this way does two things. It weans us off of the need for public validation for everything. That's the Sur Meira. But it also does an Aseh Tov. It connects me more to Hashem. Many people do not feel that they have access to a relationship with Hashem, even though we do mitzvot all the time. But this midah helps me feel more connected to Hashem. Why? Let's imagine a situation where we're all in a room right now, and there are two people here who know a secret that nobody else knows. And they look over the crowd and they kind of like wink at each other or give each other a little sign like, we know that and nobody else knows. They feel connected because of their little secrets that they carry. Ayin lo rata Elokim zulatecha means if there's a secret that me and Hashem share, nobody knows that I did that, but Hashem does. And the fact that only me and Him know makes me feel more connected to Him. As if we're like kind of winking at each other, we know about that and nobody else knows. And in the Jewish community today, unfortunately, there's a lot of superficiality. Because so many things we do because it's the right thing to do and everybody does it and that's gives you a good reputation. We need to balance this out with only Hashem knows about this. And there's something very special about looking for opportunities to do mitzvot in that way. And that's what this midah is encouraging you. Hatzneh lechad im elokecha, walk modestly with Hashem. Find things to do that only He knows about. And even when you're in public, remind yourself that He's the one who's really looking and really cares. Now that we said this, I would like to give you some applications that we see where Chazal talk about being tsanua in a way that we can understand it better now that we've given this definition. So if you look at source number 5, source number 5 is very interesting. It's a Gemara in Bava Kama. The Gemara talks about the concept of Kerem Revai. Kerem Revai is a vineyard that is at its fourth day since it was planted. Now we know the halachas of fruit, that when a person plants a fruit tree, for the first 3 years, it's considered orla. Orla means that I cannot eat it. Orla means that I cannot eat it. The fourth year, I can eat it, but I have to redeem it on coins. That's the concept of netaravai or keremravai. So really, this food is not edible. It's not kosher, if you want to call it, until I redeem it on coins. From the fifth year after planting a fruit tree, it's already allowed to be eaten without any conditions. So the Gemara is talking about netaravai. Keremravai. Person planted grapes, they're in their fourth year. You're allowed to eat them, but they have to be redeemed on coins in order to eat them. The Gemara asks a question. It says, during Shemitah year, which is relevant to right now, if a person has a kerem revai, he has grapes that really need to be redeemed before they're eaten, does he have to put out some kind of sign to warn people that this is kerem revai? Now again, Shemitah year, my food is hefker, meaning anybody who passes by my field is allowed to pluck some grapes out of my field and eat them. And therefore, if I know that these grapes cannot be eaten without the redeeming of the coins, I have to warn people, because somebody's going to walk by my field, pluck a grape and eat it, and not know that he has to redeem it on the coins. So the Gemara says that you have to leave some kind of sign next to this particular type of grapes, the ones that are in their fourth year, so that anybody who passes by sees, oh, I'm going to have to redeem those on coins. And that's pretty obvious that that's what has to be done in Shemitah. The Gemara then goes on to ask the question, what about the other 6 years when it's not Shemitah? Do I have to still keep up that sign? If I have a Kerem Revai, do I have to warn people that they're not allowed to eat it unless they redeem it? Now think about it for a second. Who are we talking about the next 6 years? Who would pluck out my grapes? Only a robber. Because in Shemitah, you're allowed to come into my field and take my grapes. But the other 6 years, that's considered robbing. And the Gemara asks a very interesting question. Do I have to warn the robber that my grapes need to be redeemed, that they're not edible without being redeemed? The modern day application would be that if you leave your house, do you have to leave a post-it note for a robber in case he breaks in? Don't touch that electric socket. You might get a shock. So we don't usually leave post-it notes for robbers telling them how to like not fall into this thing and don't touch that and don't go there. This is like kind of the equivalent. So the Gemara says that you do not have to warn the robber. And the Gemara uses a very strong pasuk. The Gemara says, Halitehu la rasha v'yamot. Which means, let the Rasha die. Or let him do whatever he does, I don't care, I'm not responsible for him. But then the Gemara goes on to say, and if you look at the third line here, Halitehu la rasha v'yamot, and the second line in the middle of source number 5. And then the Gemara says something very interesting. V'hatsnu'in manichim et hama'ot v'omrim. The tsanua people, the people who have tsniut, take coins and they redeem them kind of retroactively, that if anybody takes from this grape, these grapes have already been redeemed through these coins. Now our question is, why are these people called tsanua? The halacha is that I don't have to do this. But the tsnuim do this. They redeem the coins in case the robber comes and takes. It's already redeemed for them. Rashi says there that tsnuim are the anashim chassidim, that they're the righteous people, shirotzim l'salek yidei kol adam min avera, who want to keep everybody away from avera. Now, we have to analyze this to the light of the way we define tsnuot. We said it's the covering of the ego. So where is the ego working here? I'll tell you how it's working here. Normally, if I would say to you, do you want to help this Jew eat non-kosher? You would say no. And let's say to you, but he does other things, there are other halachot that he doesn't keep. So do you want to feed him not kosher? I would say no. I don't want him to do an extra thing, and I'm not going to facilitate him doing something that Hashem wouldn't like. So why would I allow a robber to eat from my field if it was something not kosher in the field? Because the only reason why I wouldn't care about it is because you're my robber. If you're some Jew I just meet somewhere, of course I don't want to facilitate you doing something incorrect. But since I'm angry at you that you snuck into my field, I don't really care about you anymore. Go ahead, do any averus you want, I don't really care. That's the ego talking. Because if you were just a Jew who was not robbing my field, I would care. But since I'm upset that you broke into my field, I don't care. And that, in a sense, is the ego talking. So even though I don't have to do this, Tsanua people would do this. Meaning I'm not influenced by my own biases towards you. The modern day application would be, if somebody asked you to do a favor to help a Jew who needs something, and you'd say, of course I should do this for this person. And then you find out that your mother and her grandmother didn't get along. So you say, forget it, I'm not helping this person. If you thought it was the right thing to do in the first place, and then you found out that you have a personal vendetta here, tzniut means to cover your ego and do what is right anyway. And we do this sometimes. Sometimes we have our ulterior motives, and they affect the way we do what's right or not, or what isn't right. Something that I would have done if I wouldn't have known this, but now that I have a personal vendetta here, I'm not going to do this mitzvah for you. And that is one of the manifestations of the covering of the ego, is the negating of their ulterior motives and thinking, this is the right thing to do, it doesn't matter that I don't like your grandmother. And that's called tsanua, because it's the covering of the ego. Let's look at another example. Number 6. The Gemara in Kiddushin Nun Gimel, the Gemara talks about a specific situation. I'll give you the background. The Kohanim in the Beit HaMikdash used to eat from the Lechem HaPanim. There were the 12 loaves of bread, and the Kohanim had the ability to go eat. A normal person could not eat, the Kohanim could. When the Kohanim would go eat from the bread of the Lechem HaPanim, it wasn't because they were hungry. It was because it was a special spiritual thing to eat from this bread. The Gemara talks about a time when there was no bracha in the dough, meaning for whatever reason there was a shortage of lechem upon it. There were 12 loaves, but they weren't as big as they normally were. So the Kohanim came to get the lechem upon him, and lo and behold, there's not enough bread to go around for all the Kohanim. And now we get to our Gemara. Hatznuim, number 6. Hatznuim moshchem et yadehem, v'hagargaranim cholkim. My cholkim chotvim. The tsanua people held back their hands and didn't take lechem upon him. And the gargaranim, which means the people who grab, the people who are gluttonous, would grab from the lechem upon him. Now we're not talking about people who are hungry. We're talking about people who are looking for a spiritual, something special that was in that bread. And yet in that context, the Gemara is telling you that the tsanua person holds back and didn't take. Again, what's going on here? What's that? About the Kohanim, exactly. So we have the tsanua Kohen and the not tsanua Kohen. The tsanua Kohen holds back. And try to think of how this would be in our lives. There's some kind of spiritual opportunity, and I'm running towards it. And suddenly I realize that if I get there, maybe somebody else won't get an opportunity. And the tsanua person holds back and moves out of the way and says, maybe I'll let her have a chance, it's fine. Again, the covering of the ego. Not every opportunity is only for me, 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 me. Maybe there's somebody else who needs this opportunity even more than me. And we have to think how that would look. I live in Yerushalayim, so there's a few applications of it. I don't know what it's like here, but I'll give you a few applications. Sometimes at a funeral, people want to show respect for the niftar, for the person who passed away, and people want to hold the aron, the coffin of the niftar, in order to give the last respect. Sometimes what happens is that so many people are trying to get to that position that it ends up losing the respectability that it's supposed to have. Meaning, in the desire to give respect and to be
no Siv Aaron to be holding, people are pushing to get to that place, especially when it's a big rabbi or somebody, you know, who passed away. So this person, the person who passed away, deserves lost respect. And I would like to have that opportunity. But me and many other people want to have the opportunity. So the tzenor person might say, you know what? Let him go. It's about the respect for the dead person. It's not about me. So too many people pushing makes the levaya not respectable. So I'm going to move out of the way and let him go in. Another example might be, this is, I don't know if this, if you'll relate to this, but I have a friend who's the head of a chesed community in a committee in a certain community. And she says that, you know, when a woman gives birth or somebody goes through some kind of medical procedure, so they offer meals, you know, people in the community cook for the people. She says there's two types of reactions I get. Sometimes I get the reaction like, no, I'm sorry, I just can't cook for you. And sometimes I get the opposite reaction. Somebody calls up and says, I'd like to cook for Mr. Schwartz. And then the person says, oh, we're ready, you know, we have all the meals covered, thank you so much. What do you mean? I wanted to cook for her. Can you tell somebody else that they can't do it so that I'll do it? Meaning, let's take the mitzvah away from somebody else so that I can get in there. That is not the covering of the ego. Maybe send her a meal in a month when everybody forgot about her, that would probably be even more helpful, right? But the idea is sometimes I want the mitzvah for me, and I'm not letting somebody else have an opportunity. And this, the Gemara is telling you, is another aspect of tzniut, the covering of the ego. Maybe somebody else needs this opportunity more than me. Maybe I shouldn't be trying to push for it myself. And this is another aspect. I would like to start winding down, but there's a very interesting source, number 8. The Gemara in Sanhedrin says, Adam asui shelo lahasbia et atzmo. This is a fascinating idea. This is just an observation. It's not a spiritual thing. It's an observation that the Gemara is making, that the nature of man, Adam asui, shelo lahasbia et atzmo, to not show that he is satiated. What does this mean practically? When you ask a lady, have you been getting enough sleep recently? How many people say, yes, I get so much sleep, I'm so well rested. I haven't heard that from a Jewish lady in a long time. No matter what stage of life we're in, we're always fetching that we don't get enough sleep. It's either the babies are waking up, or my back is hurting me, or something is happening. It's hard for us to say, thank you, I've been getting plenty of sleep. We like to fetch. We like to make it sound like we're not getting enough. Another kind of an example, how many women walk over to their husbands and say, you know, we have so much cleaning help in this house, maybe too much. And the husband's going to say, good, so let's cut back a few days. We don't say this. How many women on an Erev Chag, when you're cooking for 7 meals, say, that was a breeze. I'm so overwhelmed, there's so much to do, everybody can't stop talking about it. The Gemara is telling you, Adam asur shelo lasbia et atzmo. We don't want to show when we're satiated. We like to show that we're missing something. We like to fetch. I say another manifestation of this would be in Israel. You see, you know, people know when they come to Israel to visit, you go to the shuk, and everybody knows that when the person, the vendor, gives you a price, you have to bargain. So all of a sudden, everybody puts on their Middle Eastern, like, what? 8 shekel? That's too much money. I can't afford it. Only 7, you know. Now, it could be that you can easily afford that 8 shekel. But you still might get into this bantering of, what? 8 shekel? No way. You walk away. You wait for him to yell to bring you back. I don't walk over to the vendor and say, 8 shekel? That's a good price. I'll just buy it at that. That's fine. I can afford that. So again, we tend... What the Gemara is telling you is that when it comes to the physical world, we tend to cover up our assets. We don't want people to know how much money we have usually. We don't want people to think we're getting enough sleep or enough help. And why is this? Because we're afraid that if we expose it, we're going to lose it. If I let you know that I got enough sleep, you might actually ask me to take care of your baby during the night. Or if I say I have too much cleaning help, you might actually take some away from me. If I say that I can afford that item, the vendor might actually hike up the price. So when it comes to the world of physical assets, we tend to want to reflect that we have less than we have, in order to protect and not lose what we have. This leads us to a very interesting observation about tzniut. Tzniut is about the covering up, the hiding. And the observation that the Bali Musar, the altar of Kelm from the Kelm school of Musar, said this, that it's a very interesting paradox of people. We hide our physical assets because we don't want people to take them away. We're very happy to expose our spiritual assets. We don't want people to know the acts of kindness that we do and things that we do. He says, why is that? Because you're not afraid of losing it. You're not. It's not precious to you. Your money is precious to you, so you hide it. Tzniut becomes a litmus test for how precious is the thing that I'm dealing with right now. Nobody uses a money belt for $1. But when you have a lot of money and you're scared to lose it and you're walking outside, you put on the money belt or you hide it somewhere. So tzniut, therefore, is what I do when I value something and I'm afraid to lose it, I hide it. It becomes a natural thing to hide it, to cover it. Because I'm afraid, I don't want it to be exposed. You don't need to leave your money flying all around your table in your house because you're afraid it's going to get lost. You put it away. So tzniut then becomes what I do when I value something. The problem we have with spirituality is that we don't realize the importance, the value of our mitzvot. And if we realized it, we would want to protect it like we protect our money. Because we don't understand the value, we don't mind. Okay, so everybody can know about that. That's not a problem. And therefore, tzniut becomes what I do to something that I value. Now, once you have that as the working definition, then the technical aspects of tzniut, of the covering of the body, make sense as well. If I respect my body and want to preserve it and don't want it to be vulnerable and to be exposed to people's eyes, I will cover it to show the sign that I value it. And I'll do the same to my mitzvot, to anything that's important to me. It will become a natural thing to do, to cover it. And I'll give you an example. In the dating world, when a girl goes on a first date with a boy, and they have this, you know, conversation back and forth, she goes back to her dorm, and people say, how was your date? And she might actually retell the whole date. He said this, I said that, he said this. When the relationship gets more serious, as it gets more serious, she's less likely to share every detail with her friends. And when it's finally very serious, and he writes her a very beautiful romantic card, she's not going back to post that all over Stern College with all her friends. That's not going on the billboard. Why? Because it's precious to her. And when it's precious, we don't expose. This explains private aspects between us and our husbands. It explains all kinds of things that are not exposed on park benches because they're precious to us. And tzniut then becomes a midah, which is in a sense a litmus test for how much I value something or don't value it. If I value it, I want to keep it. And this is the natural extension. Okay. I would like to take questions we don't have so much time, so maybe I'll take questions for a few minutes if anybody has any direction that they'd like to ask about. If not, I'll go back to one of the sources that I didn't get to, but if anybody has a question, yes. Loud, please. Connection between tzniut and not exposing things about our husbands, you mean? Right. Okay, I didn't get to this as a topic. It's a very interesting topic. She says, what's the connection between tzniut and not exposing things about our relationship with our husbands? Did I understand you correctly? Is that right? Okay. The question really is, what's the connection between tzniut and not exposing things about relationships with our husband? So I want to say something very interesting to end up here. I didn't put it on the source sheet. But there's a very interesting direction about tzniut.
that basically says that tzniut is a form of self-preservation. And if you look at it, things that are hidden are more preserved. We could go so far as to say that the human, every creation has some form of self-preservation. The cheetah runs very fast, the chameleon changes colors, the skunk lets out a smell. God gives every creation a way to protect itself. The human's way to protect itself is by covering. Meaning, my inner organs that are precious, like my heart, is covered by the bones, the rib cage. The brain is covered by the skeleton. My skin is covered by clothing. My body is covered by my home when I go inside to protect myself from the elements. So, and of course, a soldier wears a helmet, and bike riders wear helmets, meaning the more I cover something, the more I'm trying to protect it. And that's the human's ability to protect himself. Therefore, this is a fascinating mahalach, that tzniut is about protecting my privacy. And I use this idea when I talk to children about not exposing too much information. If there's somebody who's inappropriately asking them things they're not appropriate to share, a child has to have a good radar for that was not an appropriate question. And in today's world, we have to teach our children to protect themselves. Meaning my privacy is my way to protect my identity. You're asking me things that I shouldn't have to tell you. I don't have to tell you because I'm allowed to cover up on something to maintain my privacy and my identity. Similarly, areas that are private in our relationships, our personal lives, and in our bodies, when people inappropriately ask us to expose something, they're threatening my privacy, they're threatening my identity. And I have a right to say, no, I don't want to share that information, because I have a right to try to preserve what's private to me. We can go even further as to say that society is always going to push in the direction of exposure. Blog it, put it out there, tell everybody, show it all, talk about everything. Society moves in the direction of blur your personal identity. Let everything be out there. Don't share, don't keep anything for yourself. And our fight back to that is, I'm allowed to be private with my body, with my information, with my relationships. It's not about being secretive and not friendly. It's about the fact that if you ask me to expose everything, then I turn into a nothing. I'm just part of this blur of information. And society will always push in the direction of exposure. Tzniut is pushing back. I need to protect my privacy. And our homes, when we choose to keep private information to ourselves, because the ones who we love are dear to us, I don't really want to tell you every aspect of my relationship with my husband. I also don't want to tell you my children's private information, because they're dear to me and my job is to protect them. And again, just like we said that tzniut is the antidote to narcissism, which is so prevalent in our society, it's also the antidote to that public exposure, which is very prevalent in our society. We have to remind ourselves, I have a right not to expose this and not to tell this. Not only a right, but almost an obligation to myself, to my family. And I'm thankful for the question because it allowed me to open up an aspect of this that I didn't think about. But, okay, I'm going to wind down. I'm just going to end here for today by saying that I think that what we could try to do with this Mida is to try to re-educate ourselves and our children. Unfortunately, so many times you say the word tzniut and people roll their eyes because they're not understanding this is a beautiful, beautiful concept which has so many applications. And when you explain it, even the part that people are rolling their eyes about, which is about dress code, it makes much more sense in this context. It's about protecting, it's about privacy, it's about having a relationship with God. These are very, very important values. So I would like to encourage us all to think about this Mida and its wider ramifications and to practice some of the private ramifications as they emerge from the sources. Thank you very much, everybody. Did you have a question? Oh, okay. You know, it's so good. People always ask questions that are important. The Altar of Kelm says that there's some times when we don't practice this Mida. And I'll give you three quick examples. If you're about to do a private mitzvah, and a very sensitive friend says to you, where are you going? You're going to a hospital to volunteer. That's not a place to be tsanua. Because if you're going to hurt her feelings while you're trying to be private, find a different place to be private. And sometimes tsanua is not supposed to be a block to intimacy. Intimacy means that if I'm close to somebody and they want to understand me, I'm not going to be all private because of that. Somebody once said the word intimacy could be said as into me see. People who I want to create closest to, I want them to understand me. And to start having all these little secret things that I'm not telling them would not be appropriate. Number two, public role modeling. Teachers, parents, people who can influence other people through their good actions will sometimes expose something that they're doing for the sake of raising the standard of the community. Wow, that's a beautiful thing to do, we should do that too. Is sometimes justifies going public, number two. And number three is that sometimes by going a little public, I can actually protect the mitzvah instead of diminish it. Meaning, if I'm working on my anger, and I say to you, you know I'm working on my anger, it might keep me in line and make me really work on my anger, because somebody out there knows that I am. So sometimes we will tell somebody something that we're doing because it will encourage us to have to live up to the expectation that we set for ourselves. So there definitely are some exceptions to this rule. Thank you very much. Thank you, everybody.